we're going to do, I am going to ask Rob a few questions. He's going to maybe offer a few answers. And then you people, not all of you, are going to ask some questions yourselves. So we'll do it like this. I want five people in a second to go to that yellow microphone over there. And they'll be the first five questions that we'll take. So firstly, I want someone who's got what they think is a difficult question to ask Rob. There you go. Thank you, sir. And then I want someone who thinks they got an easy question to ask Rob. Yes, sir. Now, I need a lady. I was going to say I've got two men. So I want a woman with a question to ask Rob. Come on. Yes, thank you, madam. And then I'll have one more hand further back. Anybody further back? Yes, thank you, madam, with a purple jumper. To the microphone, please. And then let's... anybody got a kind of surreal question they want to ask Rob?
Right there.
Yeah, line. That man with a check shirt.
In the surreal shirt.
Yeah, man with a surreal shirt, exactly. Okay, so that's it. You guys come to the mic, and in a second we'll come to you. So, Rob, thank you for being at Green Belt with us. How have you found the Green Belt experience to date?
Well, as you all would say, it's brilliant. I've loved it. And the whole time, I keep thinking, I need to come back and bring my family, because trying to explain this to my wife is going to be very difficult.
And how does it compare to other kind of festivals or big faith-based events you might have taken part in?
I like this one. Are you all hearing a ringing? Oh, whew. I thought that was in here. That alone makes it a very unique thing. And then there, to me, there is a certain freedom here. This whole event and interacting with you, it is grounded in a belief that it's God's world. And it always has been, and it is, and it always will be. And so there's nothing to be scared of. Wherever you find truth, wherever you find beauty, wherever you find compassion, you can embrace it, you can hug it, you can kiss it, you can absorb it, because it's God's world. And there is a certain fearlessness here, which I find absolutely compelling, that often with faith comes a sort of fear, and everything gets divided up into categories that don't work anyway. And there's a sort of embrace here of God's world that I thank you. It's very, very inspiring.
Great. Well, good having you as part of it. Well, now let's stick with that, an example of that. So I saw you were in, you've been fantastically, as a speaker, you've not just been delivering talks, but you've been engaging in the rest of the program. I've seen you all over the site. And I saw you in the Gene Robinson session yesterday, and you were very appreciative of what he had to hear, what he had to say. And it occurred to me, in relation to what you've just said, would it be difficult for you, for example, to invite Gene Robinson to speak at your church?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And why would that be the case?
This is an unbelievably divisive moment, and it looks like around the world in terms of the church. And so our church is just beginning to engage the issue of our Christian brothers and sisters who are gay in a way that I think reflects how Jesus would engage with the issue. And I tend to be a bit impatient. That might come as a shock to you. I want things done now. And it takes time. Just takes time.
Because in the U.S., some people regard you as a little bit heretical, don't they?
I've heard rumors of such things, but I, as a general practice, do not Google my name.
But what do they think is? What do they think you're kind of unorthodox or off-beam or dodgy or dangerous?
Part of my experience has been that the harshest critics also do not speak things to your face. Apparently, oftentimes with being a Pharisee comes cowardice. And so my experience has been rarely in American culture, we're much less prone to actually sit down and discuss it. People just go home and blog about it. It's actually fascinating. I don't know if we Americans, some of us who have cable, we watch your parliament debates for like, we're fascinated. We can't change the channel. And this is what's in America, what you do often for politicians is you have a series of sound bites and you just give those short, crisp sound bites. And then if somebody raises a question about one of your sound bites and points out that perhaps you have avoided, there's a nuance there, or you have made something black and white that's a bit more complex. What you do then is you go back to your cue cards and you read the sound bites again, only louder. And so eventually if you just keep saying them, but what you do here is you actually discuss things. As a friend of mine said, the English still believe in language. And we find this fascinating.
Great.
Okay, let's have our first question from our audience.
Which one was this, by the way? This was the hard one?
Go on, it's fine.
First of all, can I just say, from everybody, on behalf of the whole of Greenbelt, congratulations on your baby little girl.
Well, you're very good. Thank you.
Okay, I think he's softening you up.
So, I'm not softening you up. It's just, you know, I think it's best placed to be polite. My question is, I'm a new Christian, and out of the Bible, which bit of the Bible, the chapter, would you recommend myself as a new Christian to read, and why?
I would start probably with the Sermon on the Mount, or maybe I might start in Genesis through Revelation. Just kind of work through that. I probably the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Because at the center of it, Jesus says to pray, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So Jesus grounds heaven here, and in the Sermon on the Mount is this unbelievably condensed. Here's how to live, essentially, and it covers such a vast array of life. From forgiving people to fidelity in relationships to it just covers so much in such a short amount of words. So I'd probably start there. And welcome to the family.
Okay, thanks. Next question, please.
Hi. A couple of years ago or more, Mike Iaconelli used to come and stand on that stage and look out at these huge crowds and sort of tell us about how he would go back home to his church in California that he'd grown from 90 to 50 people.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, do you ever wish that you were going home to a really, really small church?
Yes, I do.
And why? And tell us a bit more.
You only get one question.
We're British.
Yeah, and I would, my wife and I and some friends 10 years ago started a church, and it grew quite rapidly, and people call it a mega church, and that has lots of strengths, and it has lots of minuses. And I know for you all, you kind of look at the American mega church thing and think, that's a bit dodgy. It is. And the problem is that a large, massive group of people who have gathered for an hour a week can easily deceive themselves into thinking that that's church. But church is this sort of revolutionary movement of people who have the body and the blood at their center, who see themselves as we are here to break our bodies and to pour out our blood for the healing of the world. And what can easily happen is the show, the hour on Sunday, the big exciting thing, can easily become a surrogate for actual community. So like in the New Testament, there are 19 one another's, bear each other's burdens, forgive each other, pray for each other. Those 19 one another's, you can do a couple of them in a large gathering. And a large gathering can easily become about how entertaining or convenient it is. But actually being a person of integrity and fidelity and compassion is very inconvenient. Seeing that your divine call is to meet the world at its greatest points of suffering, there's a cross in the middle of all this. And so we have had to spend a great deal of time deconstructing ourselves and saying to people, we're thrilled that you are here, but we don't want you to be confused that this is in some way the church. Church is what happens when we journey together, when we learn to move towards the other, the person not like us, the person who most annoys us. That's church. And there are times, like with my kids, church for them, like we driving to this, we meet in a mall that somebody gave us, like you do. There are people who sit in the section that used to be a store that they used to steal things from. So even with my kids, okay, like saying, hey, this thing is not normal. We were just visiting a church on holiday a couple weeks ago that was like 100 people, and all the people knew each other.
You and see, over here, 100 people in the church is a mega church.
Yes, exactly. But it was, I literally with my kids, and you have to kind of like try to expose them to things. So yes, there has been a personal cost, and at the same time, just celebrating this has happened in our midst, and it's a beautiful thing.
So let me just follow through on that. What are the indices that you look for that tell you that this mega church is becoming an actual church? What are the signs of life that it's a true Christian community?
One of the things we don't do is judge it by how many people came on a Sunday. Because that sort of numbers thing isn't interesting. What's interesting to me is there's a group of business people, and they live in a town called Hudsonville, which is like a farm village. And a couple of them are engineers, and they took a trip to Rwanda and saw the water crisis up close and figured out, don't our factories and our engineering degrees, couldn't we design a water system that would catch rainwater? And so they have been now going back and forth to Rwanda, installing and empowering and equipping mm-hmm. the locals to install these water systems so they can have clean water. And so for us, and if you knew Hudsonville, you would be laughing right now, but when business people from Hudsonville are hiking into remote villages in Rwanda, we think that's a bit of heaven crashing into earth. Okay. So we look for stories because we believe Jesus wants to save the church. And so we look for all these people have gathered. There is all of this resource and energy and passion and skill. And if it does not get converted mm-hmm. into blessing for those who need it the most, it will turn in on itself. So we speak of the ongoing conversion of the church. Because if the church gets saved, the mountains tremble. And that's how we kind of frame it for people.
Great, thanks. Next, please.
Hi.
Hello, I'm a little bit short. I enjoyed your Gongismos sermon in September last year.
Oh, anyway. Well done. Yes.
It was very good. Anyway, I've been thinking about evangelism recently, and my experience in the past has, I think, it's either been lazy and sort of making excuses how you're just loving people and it will happen and it doesn't, or really arrogant. And when it's over proactive, it seems quite arrogant to me. And I was wondering if you had any wisdom on the balance between that.
On the wisdom between lazy and arrogant?
In a sort of friendship evangelism, sometimes, I don't know, it almost seems slightly lazy. I don't know.
But okay, thanks. That's a good question. What's your name?
Alison.
Hi, Alison.
Hello.
I just asked your name to stall so I can think of an answer. Where are you from? What do you like to do? Okay, this is the Bible Unfortunately for many, the Bible is not a nice, cohesive, systematic theology, no matter what you're taught in seminary. It's not like God is A, God is B, God is C, subpoint A. It's a collection of stories and poems. So it is fundamentally a narrative. And the narrative has a point. It has key characters, among them God. But the overall genre is story. There's a human history is a story that is unfolding. And so I fundamentally begin with there is a story that is unfolding and we are each invited to find our role in it. So if you are involved in the story and living in the story, you generally don't defend stories or try and convince people of stories. Your general posture towards a story is you find it captivating and you just love telling it. The second thing is that when you have a great story, you generally aren't thinking in terms of how do I convince other people that it's right or true. Your interest is in just telling it well because you assume that they will be captivated by the same things that you're captivated by. So if you are living in the story, I would assume then naturally it informs the way that you think and that when you talk about it, it would be less kind of a how do I jam the gospel into this situation. You know, those kind of awkward Christian conversations where we're talking about football and all of a sudden they're like, oh, they just scored. You know, Jesus scored for you. And it's kind of this, and so my assumption is that living in this story, you know, it's been said, preach the gospel always and sometimes use words. My assumption is that if you are in true relationship with somebody, there will be key moments when you make a particular decision that will naturally bring out the conversation. You forgave somebody, and normally people would not forgive in this situation. Well, how can you go back and be kind to them? Well, I've been captivated by this idea of forgiveness. It shapes the way I think things. I see it as a gift I've received that I get to extend to others. Do you know what I mean? And so hopefully it becomes a sort of natural, free-flowing sort of thing.
I believe in that. But okay, my good. Experience is that it's quite lazy.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe that's just impatience.
Thank you, Alison. Let me just follow through on that, because I'm intrigued by the notion of story, because story is elusive, it's open-ended, it can be interpreted in different ways by different people, whereas often evangelism is closed. It's more of the box, it's have you believed enough of the right stuff at the right time? Have you made it across into our world?
Yes, and going back to your question, the sense of impatience, to me, fundamental to every human interaction is that this person was created by a God, this God loves them more than I ever possibly could, that this person has been created in the image of God, and that they belong to God in some very profound sort of way. And that part of my interaction with them is any sort of healthy relationship begins with me surrendering my desire to control them. So the degree to which I share my faith in Jesus has to begin with whatever the outcome, I still am going to love and embrace them as a fellow human being. So I understand your, but you get impatient. But a healthy human interaction begins with, this person belongs to God. I have the unique opportunity to be in relationship with them, but they are not mine to control for my own purposes. And that frees you in all sorts of profound ways.
Thank you. Okay, next question, please.
Next question, please.
Was this easier or harder? What one was this?
This is a killer.
It's a killer. Killer.
I'm following on from your talk this morning about growing older. I'm British, so it's in two parts. firstly, what advice can you give us for managing encounters with people who have grown old and inflexible, and rather being fresh and green, have turned into skeletal trees? And my second part is, how do I avoid becoming a skeletal, dried, inflexible tree myself?
Well, you can't control people or places, but you can help expose them to realities they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. So if you have people that you are close to who are old and brittle, how can I lovingly expose them to things they might not see? My grandmother died last year on my birthday. We were that close. But for the 10 years previous to that, we had lunch every Friday. And my grandma grew up on the farm. She's just old school, to say the least. And so what I did over the 10 years is she often paid, which was lovely. But I would invite people to lunch with us, and I would never tell her who was coming. And I invited the most random assortment of humanity to have lunch with us. And I watched her go from... I watched her open up in such unbelievable ways. And there was this one guy that I had gotten to know, and he was just coming off of a serious LSD addiction. So he kept having these relapsing, like kind of psychotic dreams where he would get captured with these images and he couldn't, his brain was still coming down from the drugs. And he just looked like kind of death warmed over. And I brought him to lunch one time and just to see what would happen, kind of. And the two of them connected, like in this unbelievable way. And it's a true story. As he began to, essentially as the drugs began to leave his system, he began to be alive in some really powerful ways and ended up finishing college and sensed that he was supposed to go study, go to seminary and be a pastor. And she, when she heard this, told me, I want to pay for his theological education without him knowing. So she funded the whole thing. And he's now a pastor at our church. And after he graduated, I got to tell him, hey, by the way, did you figure out who paid for it? And he had. But apparently she was loaded. but like that to me, it is, and there is a power to the meal. When people eat together, something happens. So it's exposure. And then for you, when you find yourself feeling old about something, like the kids nowadays, hopefully our radar is up to those experiences that make us feel old and moving towards them, not away from them. So when I first heard about Twitter, it made me feel old. Like, Twitter is the most ridiculous thing ever. And then a couple weeks ago, my brother got me, like, a Twitter account, and I'm totally into it. but I think part of it is listening to your own sort of radar, your own sort of instincts. This thing right here, I don't get it. It makes me, and to move towards it with a sort of expectant discovery, and then all sorts of things happen.
Okay, thank you. Right, now just before the surreal question, let me ask one I primed you on earlier. The American novelist, preacher Will Campbell was once asked to sum up Christianity in less than 10 words. And he thought about it for a second. He said, "We're all bastards, but God loves us anyway." So that was 8 words. Now, can you sum up the essential kernel of the way of Jesus in 10 words or less?
Every tiny little bit. Did I use one or two? That's two syllables of one word.
Yeah, it's not syllables. You're in Britain now, you can use many syllables.
Somebody yesterday used the word controversy, and it took me like a half hour to work through that one. Oh, controversy. I got it. Every little bit of hope. You stumble across is real. How's that? Now can I use 100 words to explain those 10?
That's very good. That's very good. I like that. Thank you. I'll keep that.
Okay, good.
I might even use it.
Okay.
So, Mr. Surreal, please.
Can I touch it? I've touched it. Another word, station wagon. Nah, nobody understood that, Steve Hobb.
You know, I wondered about that.
Nah, you're in England. Right then, I'm a sculptor.
Was that a question?
No, it was just a correction.
Can I correct it? Can I say what it is now?
No, my question. Men in Black, as you said yesterday, invite artists round for dinner, and then they carve soap for you. I'm a sculptor, and I invite gardeners round to my house who then make things for me. And my question is, Rob, and I have a gift for you. I'm swine flu free. And I'm going to give you some of it. And my question is, what is it?
Can you all in the back see this? It's a carrot, I believe. Is that the word for it, carrot? Or is the word station wagon? Only it looks like a pair of legs that are crossed. Is this what you mean by you're a sculpture? A sculptor? Okay. All right.
So, I mean,
your job was to ask a surreal question. Well done.
So,
do you see what I mean by telling my wife my time at Greenbelt? Well, there was this guy, and he gave me a carrot that looked like two legs. Never mind.
So I think we'll have another five questions. So anybody got a kind of slightly angry question? Have we got a hand, a slightly angry question? Anybody? Yeah, okay, thank you. Number one. Anybody got a kind of I'm slightly in love with Rob question? Yeah, there you go. Okay, anybody got a theological question?
Oh.
Okay.
Yes.
Anybody got another question? And then, okay, sorry, yeah, so that's fine. Okay. Yeah, lady in blue first.
Thank you. People over here. Hello. There we go. A little suspicious there. And I got to keep them in line.
Here we go.
Hiya.
Hi.
This has just really come to me in the last couple of minutes, really. My father is an atheist, and the rest of my family are believers. And I find it very difficult as a Christian. I've been a Christian all my life. To think that God, an all-loving God, would send my father, if he was to die, to hell, if you like. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
I find that difficult as well.
But sometimes you come across people who will just blatantly tell you that's what's going to happen. And how would you deal with that if you're in that situation? Because I'm in that situation a lot, where people, you know, oh, your father's going to hell. And I don't really know how to respond to that. So can you help?
Yeah, I would... first and foremost... Well, like Billy Graham, an American, he said in the August issue of Newsweek magazine 2006, he said when it comes to atheists, Muslims, Hindus, he said, it is not my job to go around making statements about who's going where. My job is to announce that God's love for every human being is absolute. Can I get an amen? But I mean, it's very interesting. It's very interesting to me that kind of an icon of evangelism in the world in his later days is very strongly committed to our job is to announce that God's love expressed in Jesus Christ is for all of creation. And Tim Keller, a pastor in Manhattan, has a new book called Reason for God. And he's just very clear on our job is to announce the love of God expressed in Jesus Christ. Our job is not to go around saying, you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. Which it seems to be one of the primary impulses of the Pharisees in Jesus' day was that our job is to sort of make these announcements about the eternal destinies of people. And Jesus seems to be like, not your job. You're not very good at it anyway. Not your job. How God sorts all of this out, I don't know. But I do know that my particular journey, and I would imagine yours, is God's grace in my journey seems to just get bigger and bigger and bigger. Would anybody back that up? That it seems as though the life of Christ takes you into an ever-expanding understanding and awareness of the love and grace of God. I mean, Paul even says, he's like, how wide and immeasurable and how deep. What often happens then is there is a Christian voice that says, no, and wants to immediately shrink that down to something that is manageable and that you can get a systematic theology around. But one of the things that God continually does is blast whatever system we create. Seems to quite enjoy that, the smashing of boxes. And so I would say that as you follow Jesus, and what also happens in the critique that you sounds like you are bumping up again is people say, well, then Jesus doesn't matter. What about the cross? Perhaps for you in the interactions that you are having where you refuse to say these statements that they do, and I assume the criticism is, well, don't you care about the cross? Doesn't Jesus matter? Perhaps there's a sort of judo move. Oh, no. I'm not denying Jesus or the cross. I'm just leaving room for Jesus and the cross to may even be bigger than the Jesus and the cross that you are speaking of. So for me, this isn't an issue of disregarding it, and this isn't an issue that I don't take it seriously. I just am trying to take it more seriously than maybe you even are. And maybe you shouldn't say that because people get really riled up then. But I would argue that you're sort of, sounds like you have a sort of instinctual, I can't go there in regards to my father. And I would argue it is not because you just want a nice, happy world where nothing matters, but your experience with the resurrected Christ is opening up all sorts of things rather than shrinking them down. And that is a beautiful thing, and all of us together, we affirm you in that. And the tears that you are shedding, we feel we're with you. We're with you.
Thank you.
Hi. I was just interested, since the publication of Velvet Elvis and the success of the Numa films and everything, how you managed to kind of keep it real and keep your feet on the ground and spend time with your family and stuff like that, and you're traveling all around the world and it must be tricky. And I was just wondering how you managed to keep a balance between all those things.
That's a great question. My wife and I, like I get up in the morning and make my boys breakfast and then make sure that their lunches are packed for school and then take them to school, and then they're done with school at 3:30 and I pick them up, and then there's either football practice or music practice, and then we make dinner, and then we have this new baby named Violet, and Violet Eileen has diapers that need to be changed, and then the lawn needs to be mowed. So we live a terribly normal life, and I have friends who are deeply committed to us living a very normal life. I haven't probably traveled much, if any, in the past year and a half. I've been home day after day after day. Actually, my wife in February, she gave birth in April, but in February had got some sort of pregnancy-induced asthma and couldn't breathe. So she was in and out of the hospital, and we were in the emergency room all night, and then she had to have an oxygen tube and was confined to a chair pretty much for about 3 months there. So we've really been home. For us, you cannot invite people into a life and into a way of life and into the way of Jesus if it is not something that you are experiencing yourself to some degree. So we begin with what is a life that works for our family. So I'm home every night for dinner. Saturday is a Sabbath where like we turn off phones and we, as a family, we play, we rest. I have a little gig on Sundays sometimes. And then from there, what are things that I can be involved in? So I don't even go into the church office really much. If I teach half the Sundays at our church on Sundays and meet up with people here and there, but I don't want to live some sort of like, well, I can fit you in for 3:30, but I'm very busy at 4.
Following through on that, I mean, is it difficult to not to believe in the publicity? I mean, if you go in the bookshop, there's a lot of product. You're obviously phenomenally successful.
I'm like, who is that guy? Ugh.
But, I mean, do you have to kind of critically distance yourself and remind yourself?
To be honest, I haven't signed a book in a year and a half because our experience has been that whatever you call it, fame or whatever that is, and authentic, true Jesus community are fundamentally mutually incompatible. They don't work. So I'll go home tomorrow morning, tomorrow evening. I'll probably mow the lawn, and then there's a bee's nest in our garage that the bees are driving us crazy, so I'll have to deal with that. I mean, I will just go right back to everyday normal life. My experience has been that if you can't find God and the holy in the everyday, then you're going to have a hard time finding God in the mountaintop experience. And so we have tried to organize our life around the holiness and the sanctity of everyday matters. And this is absolutely amazing. When I came here, I was like, who are these people gathered to hear? This is like I don't understand. It's just, I'm... so that's how I deal with it. And then I just try and create the next thing. So the next book or the next sermon, I wake up in the morning and work on that. And that's all I get, is I get to work on the next thing, and it brings me great joy to make it. And the fact that apparently it helps other people, that's amazing. That's like a bonus. That's like, are you kidding me? That is crazy. That people are buying that book. Unbelievable. There must be a God.
Okay. Next, please.
Hi. I've just recently become a Christian. And my parents are very atheist, and so is all of my family. And I was just wondering if you could recommend something to me, or like a passage in the Bible or something that could help me deal with it better than I am doing now.
Yeah. This is tough, huh? Do you have good friends around you? Are they Christians? So you have some around you. Yeah, I would recommend a book called Letters from a Skeptic. And it is a friend of mine named Greg Boyd. By the way, Greg Boyd would be amazing here. What a dude. He wrote a book called The Myth of a Christian Nation. But his father's an atheist, and he and his father began an exchange of letters that lasted for a number of years. Has anybody read this book? Very, very, very powerful, very human kind of interaction. That may help you at a certain level. And you belong to God. You are a sacred, precious creation and a daughter. And for some reason, you're in a very difficult position, but your family belongs to God, and you will be given the strength to get through this. Can we give our sister some support here, please?
Thank you.
Hi. You talked about a Sabbath and how you like to do that every week with your family and stuff. And personally, I find it quite hard to do that. And I just wondered whether you, what you find hard about it, and how, and what you do on that day, and what constitutes your rest, and how you find that.
Great question. First off, I would simply ask, what feeds your soul? Because you're not a machine, no matter what your employer tells you. You are not a machine. And what can easily happen in modern life is you start to feel like a number, clock in, clock out, put in the hours. And the gift of the Sabbath, it's a disruption in the modern system, which easily turns people into machines. You are what you produce. Your worth comes from how much you earn, how much work, how efficient you are. The Sabbath says, no, 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 no. Your worth comes because you belong to God. So the Sabbath confronts the culture that says we're machines and that we're human doings. It confronts you with the truth that you're a human being. So first off, what feeds your soul? What is it that when you do it, it puts you back together? Some Sabbaths, I'll literally have a sort of prayer. God, I just took 6 days and I had some things broken and some things pulled apart. And so could you put those back together? And then the question is, what is it that if I put it aside, I would, on the other side of Sabbath, have fresh energies? An example for my wife is lists. For her, the week is driven by lists. Any moms here? Yes, you know all about that. So for her, there's this Saturdays when there aren't any lists. That for me, it's creating stuff. I can actually do lists just fine on Sabbath, but it's creating stuff, because that's what I do the other days, is I come up, arrange words, make things. And when we first began to realize, oh my word, if we don't take a Sabbath every week, we're going to just fry and burn out. It was very hard. We would have like a sort of depression by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Nobody's called. Do I still matter? Because the Sabbath confronts all of this. You realize the sort of insane adrenaline rush that is many days. So it will take a while. It will take a while to turn off. If you talk to people about, okay, what day of the week do you turn your cell phone off? People like twitch. You know, like, what do you mean? One day a week I turn. What day of the week do you not return email? Well, I mean, if I didn't return email, you what? You wouldn't matter? You know, you would, what? So what are the things that you can't imagine going a day without? And that's probably the first entrance point in. What are the things where you think, oh, I could never go a day without that? That might be something. And then in the Jewish tradition, you prepare for Sabbath all week long. They even Friday night, you light a candle and you invite the spirit of the Sabbath in. The Sabbath is coming. And so you literally prepare days out so that on that day, you are free. What do you want to do today? What would feed our soul the most? We don't have to be anywhere. We don't have to do anything. A Sabbath is a day on which all of your work is done, even if it isn't. Sabbath is a day when we're reminded that we are human beings, not human doings. A Sabbath is a day when you're reminded that God creates and sustains the world, not you. And I think we need Sabbath more than ever, to be honest. And it's an art form. It's an art form. And it's unbelievable the energy that you have for the rest of your life. So, it's a couple thoughts on Sabbath.
Thank you. Yep.
Hello.
Hi, Rob.
Did I meet you early?
Yes, you saw my book. Thank you very
much. And your name was what?
My name's David.
David. Welcome.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
I just want to thank you for all your work, and you probably don't understand it, and I follow you not because you're famous, and I think that probably is the same for everyone here. Your work is perceptive and intelligent and deep and Christian.
What's the question?
The question is that I've turned to you, your videos, when church has not touched me. I've been through a crisis of divorce, mental illness, and I wanted to know, who do you turn to in a crisis? Are theologians from the past, and are there any older Christian ministers or theologians living at this time who you turn to in a crisis?
Thank you.
Yeah, I go to spiritual direction with a nun on a regular basis. Her name is Sister Virginia, and she's from Boston, Massachusetts. And I sit with her, and she is unbelievable. She just reads my mail. It's unreal. And she has helped me through a great number of things. There's a counselor friend of mine who I've sat with for many years. And then I have a friend who calls me every day to remind me that he loves me and we're going to be fine. And so I have some people that I feel like they're gifts to me who have carried me through very difficult things. And they're great. They're just great. So number of people. Yeah.
Anyone famous?
Pardon?
Anyone famous?
Did you just say anyone famous?
Yeah.
Well, Sister, is it Virginia?
Yeah, Sister Virginia.
She's famous now.
She's famous now.
Yeah. Can I just say, right up there, I think it's still up there this year, is a venue called Soul Space. Is that right? Yeah. And if any of you are interested in spiritual direction, any of you are interested in starting this little journey Rob's just mentioned, that is a great place to visit later tonight or tomorrow to find out how to get into it.
Yeah, actually, I don't know how many of you are familiar with spiritual direction. Is that something that you talk about all the time?
No, you talk about it.
Well, I think for many people, there's like counseling or therapy, which is basically, tell me about your father. And then they kind of pick apart and give you theories and kind of help pull apart all the things that are going on inside of you. But spiritual direction, the Dominican tradition, there are quite a few traditions at which spiritual direction, and a spiritual director is somebody who isn't interested in charging and giving their opinion or telling you what to do. What they're interested in is asking you the kinds of questions that will pull out of you what the Spirit of God happens to be doing at this moment in your life. So what a spiritual director does is just begins to ask questions and listen and to guide you through. And what does that lead to? And what do you know about that? And in your experience, how does that unfold? And it's very, very, very powerful. Sometimes you just sit in silence. But it is an ancient art, and it is extraordinary how helpful it is. So if you are providing them, that's great.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a whole. I was going to use the word army. That's the wrong word. There's a whole
there's an community army of spiritual directors.
Of spiritual directors up there,
ready to conquer something.
Exactly. Ready to listen to you. So help yourselves. Thank you. And then I want three people over this side to think of a question, and then we're probably going to wrap up. So get it ready, and I'll point to you. Yeah, you come first, sir. And that very nice lady. Anybody else? And this young chap here. That's it. That'll do. Come on up.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a bit of a cheeky question. Okay.
So it's a bit cheeky?
Bit cheeky. Okay. Yeah, no, I really like your ministries and stuff. I just wonder if they'd have more of an impact if they were, well, either cheaper or available online for free. So
yeah, they
yeah.
I actually am working on a new film project, not Numa's, and that is one of the driving things, is they need to be available free everywhere in the world all the time. So, yeah, there's some YouTube stuff that... Thank you. You're kind of proud of yourself for that. That was awesome. Kind of the idea even of going to a store and buying a hard copy of things, it's like that's so 2002 or whatever. But yeah, the next film project that I'm working on will, that's the goal, that you'll be able to get it in all sorts of interesting ways.
Okay, I just want you to think of...
I can't tell you the name yet.
I want you to think of a
and
joke.
And when it has one, I may tell you.
I want you to think of a joke while I tell my joke, okay? So I read this in the paper the other day, so it's not mine. I know that my father is looking down on me somewhere right now. He's not dead, he's just really condescending. I thought that was quite good. Okay. Have you got one?
Oh, nothing that good.
Okay, next question.
Okay, this is something I've been thinking about and struggling, but you talk about narratives a lot. And there's this kind of narrative in the Bible of the fall, and you've got Eden, and then man messes up, and this explains suffering in the world. But if you kind of take the scientific approach, and I consider myself a bit scientist, and you kind of view evolution, how do you fit kind of a full narrative with this understanding there was, in history, was there ever an Eden, a perfect world?
Okay, how much time do we have? First off, those opening chapters of Genesis, I would say that the storyteller there was interested. The way in that particular culture that you told a story is, how did the world get to be this way? Here's how we got here. Some call it the more than literal truth. So the goal in that particular culture, in that particular form of literature, the goal was less getting the historical moments perfectly lined up and more getting at the meaning and what got us here. So an example would be when we tell history in the modern world, we're like, okay, no, did it happen in 1823 or 1824? And were there six people or five? Like, that's what we consider whether it's true or not. But in the ancient world, in certain settings, what you find is, I don't know exactly what happened, but was it true? So I would read the beginning of Genesis less like, okay, did the snake have two legs or three? And more the storyteller saying, from the very beginning, humans have had a propensity to rebel against God-given boundaries. The story of the Tower of Babel begins with the invention of the brick. Somebody invented a brick, and with a brick you can stack things faster and higher. So the passage dealing with the Tower of Babel begins with a new technology. Humans, from very early, have often had this propensity to use new technology to inflate our sense that we are gods, which all of a sudden makes the story have a bit of meaning for us today, maybe. Does that make sense? So when I read Genesis 1 and 2, I am not trying to take the Genesis 1 poem, which is what it was, and line it up with some sort of, okay, was creation on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and was it at 4 or 5 in the afternoon? I am reading it, what is true about this that's always been true? And so that frees me then to look around at the world of science. And instead of faith and science, and the two of them on the one hand, on the other, fighting, it becomes a sort of embrace. And that's, to me, a much more Jesus way of seeing things. As they don't have to fight, they can be friends.
Thank you. Thank you. Yep.
Hello.
Hello. In the Bible, I think probably somewhere in Acts, it says, when you're baptized in the Holy Spirit, you will speak in new tongues and prophesy. But I think we don't really see that happening now. And I know, especially in the UK, it's something that is sort of an option rather than something that should happen. And should we be taking hold of this? Or is it something that we should be doing that we're just sort of ignoring because it doesn't seem to be happening?
First off, I think that the passages in Acts, I would say it's more descriptive than prescriptive. I think it's less, okay, everybody has to do this or else, and more, here are some of the things that were happening then. There are plenty of traditions and expressions around the world right now where speaking in tongues is practiced and is a standard way people view things. Sometimes the speaking in tongues simply refers to putting the gospel in language that it hasn't been put in before. Other times it refers to a sort of ecstatic sort of prayer language. But what's interesting in the New Testament is when tongues are spoken of, there's all sorts of very kind of strong, it should be done like this, it should be in an orderly fashion, there should be, it's not kind of like, well, just start. In America, there was a movement a couple years ago of people making animal noises in church. And there was a sort of like, well, you know, hey, it's the Spirit of God. Yeah, but the guy sounds like a donkey. So at some point, is this just weird? But what's interesting in the New Testament is it's always under sort of strict, be really careful. If people are having this sort of ecstatic experience with the Spirit of God, be really careful, and this is my translation, that it doesn't become a sort of freak show. Do you know what I mean? And my experience has been with speaking in tongues is for every experience where it's a genuine, authentic, wow, these people are really having something, there are other experiences where it becomes a strange sort of thing that actually alienates people. It becomes those crazy religious people over there, when in fact the idea of the moving of the Spirit is that people would be drawn in to it. So people do practice this, but it has to be done with great, great discernment and wisdom and all that.
What about prophecy? Because when it says when you're baptized in the Holy Spirit, you should prophesy, is that sort of some people may? Is that talking about a gift of prophecy? Or is it saying that all people can?
Well, I think that you have to make a distinction. Sometimes, for many people, what prophecy means is telling exactly what's going to happen in the future. By the way, if it's a prophecy conference, then why do they have to advertise?
Oh, that was his joke.
Nice. But actually, in the Hebrew scriptures, the prophecy much more often means speaking truth. So there is a prophetic element to social justice issues. Somebody who's willing to stand up and speak the truth. So I see it less as how can we predict what's going to happen, because the Christian tradition is filled with this is going to happen. The world's going to end in 2008. Apparently it's 2000. And more speaking the truth, even when it's unpopular. Yes.
Have you come across any sense of prophecy at Greenbelt this weekend?
Actually, yeah.
Say a little more.
Let me use the word prophetic, okay, as opposed to prophecy. You all have a consciousness in several key areas that is just accepted, and I would use the word mainstream, that is only now beginning to find its ground and voice in American culture. An example would be in American culture, you drive whatever size vehicle you want because you're an American. I mean, this is a standard God-given right that you can drive a giant automobile. The idea that your fuel consumption has very real consequences for people all around the world is a foreign idea to many Americans. And actually, to talk about our consumption and its implications and consequences for other people around the world can be a very heretical, are you challenging the freedom and the rights we have as Americans? Yeah, I am. But there is a sort of prophetic voice. I mean, here at Greenbelt, issues of sustainability, recycling, really basic things like that. These are actually new ideas in America. And even the times I've spent here, I go back with a sort of, they are so far ahead of us. There is a sort of prophetic role that I would argue the church in Europe and the UK is playing with the American church and saying these are issues that you must embrace and do something about.
I was wondering whether you might have sensed anything prophetic in the service this morning.
Oh my, you want me to get started on that?
Just briefly.
Yeah, it. The idea that in the issues in Israel-Palestine, for many Americans, the idea that there are two sides to the story and the idea that just charging in with a lot of Bible verses about how it's their land, deal with it, the idea that there may be serious oppression and injustice here, this is a brand, brand new idea to many, many people. This is an idea, more and more people in America are open to, wait, there are two sides to this. And there's a whole side that we have not heard. That will be something. And then there are those of us who are, even there being here today and realizing, you all, this is amazing what you are doing, because we will have to embrace this. But in America, there is the flag and Israel and unquestioned support. And that unquestioned support needs to be questioned. And that will take prophetic courage to do, and it's absolutely necessary. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Last question, please.
Rob, in seeking to engage a minister in a postmodern, post-Christendom context, what's your understanding of absolute truth and the legitimacy of hanging on to a grand narrative?
Yeah, there's a nice one to wrap things up. I think that part of the there's something awesome going on up there. I feel like I'm missing it.
Someone will sign afterwards and turn their mugs.
you are wearing a placard and it says something about return your mugs. And someone right here is returning their mug. The prodigal is coming home. The father is in the driveway. I knew you'd come back and squandered my cup. And, I think there's been a... I'm a Christian, so I take very seriously the Jesus story. I take very seriously that history is headed somewhere, and that there's an open tomb, and that we can be a part of this, that there's a whole new creation bursting forth right in the middle of the old one. And so I think with some of the deconstruction of some of the ways in which absolute truth has been abused, people have tossed the whole idea of truth out. And then it all just becomes like, hey, your story and your story and your story. Hey, that's cool, that's cool. But I take very seriously truth and a living, breathing truth of Jesus and the invitation to follow him. And so deconstruction is very popular. Like, let's just tear it all to shreds. But then you don't end up with much of a story. You're just endlessly, well, you know, we don't buy that anymore. And you end up with not much. And the beauty of the Jesus story is an invitation to live in history with an assumption that history is headed somewhere and that we're going to be okay and that our actions matter.
So yeah. where do you stop in terms of, you know, the Christian thought
police? We stop very soon.
All right, sorry.
Can you do it really quick?
Well, just in terms of, where are the boundaries in being able to ask questions and deconstruct as a Christian?
Well, part of the freedom is you can ask anything. I mean, even the scriptures themselves are filled with people asking pretty much every question. The Book of Lamentations is sometimes God on trial. So apparently our tradition is very, very free to whatever it is, feel free to ask it. It's not like God's going to be like, woo, oh, I can't handle that. Oh, no. Postmodern, ooh, you're going to quote Foucault on me. Ah, what am I going to do? Peter Rollins talked last night about this very issue of doubt and its place in God's economy, and I thought it was absolutely spot on. So this tradition can handle pretty much anything. And then when we're done with that, we get out this bread, we get out some wine, and we gather around a table, and everything's good. So there you go.
Listen, that was a good conversation. These were really interesting questions.
Yes.
You've sat in the cold, and you've been a compelling audience. If you would like to see this man back at this festival in the next couple of years, please give him a big round of applause. Thank you.
Thanks. Man, oh man, oh man.
And you really must look after your carrot.
My what?
Your carrot.
Oh, yeah, my carrot.
You got it here.
Thank you. It's seriously, it's been a huge honor to be here, and now I'm going to take my carrot and go back to America. Thank you.